We knew her first from her character Ernestine, the telephone operator on Laugh-In. Then we got to know Lily Tomlin through her other characters, like the 5-year-old Edith Ann, Tess the bag lady, and Tommy Velour, the lounge singer. She brought her characters together in several Emmy Award-winning TV specials and 2 Tony Award-winning Broadway shows. Lily Tomlin also starred in the films Nashville, The Late Show, 9 to 5, The Incredible Shrinking Woman, All of Me, and Big Business. Tomlin's just revived her one-woman show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. It's running through the end of the year in Philadelphia. Although each character she does in the show seems to reveal something about herself, the show is actually written by Jane Wagner, who has written most of Tomlin's material since 1972. I asked Lily Tomlin how she and Wagner worked together to create the characters.
Jane absolutely writes for her own satisfaction, you know. And no matter how much I ask her to write for me, I can't influence her to that degree. I mean, she's going to write something when she wants to or she feels inspired to write it. So occasionally I might, there might be something that I've begun to physicalize that I would like to have something beautiful and definitive to for whom to say, you know, words for that character. And I will implore her to do it for me, and finally she might. But mostly she will just hand me material. I mean, that's why I sought her out in the first place, because I was so attracted to her sensibility and I wanted so much to deepen what I was doing. And I just understood what she was, I understood her for some reason.
I'm interested in how you developed your style of character comedy. When you first started performing, did you ever do stand-up?
Well, that's how I was characterized, as doing stand-up, but I always did monologues. And I always wanted them to have content, and I wanted them to have relevancy, and I wanted them to have a beginning and an end, and, you know, shape and this and that. And even if I would invent a first-person approach to something, I would eventually put it in the mouth of a character because it was just more telling. It was stronger, more definitive, had more shape, more essence. And but I did it in clubs all the time. I mean, I'd force the poor old nightclub audience to just sit there and watch a long, you know, like a 10 or 15 minute monologue. And I would never, and I, once I was committed to that, I would just do it.
So who were some of the early characters that you developed before television?
Well, the very first character I ever did was the Tasteful Lady. And that was, I was in college and I was in pre-med, and I never expected I never expected to go into show business, and so, but I got into a college show, and they were doing vignettes and things like that, and I thought they were very sophomoric and empty, and they were nothing but parodies of television shows, and it turned out they needed some more material. The show was a little short, so I realized watching them that I did stuff like that, that I did little character, you know, hits, and so because we were living in Detroit, and Grosse Pointe is one of the rich suburbs of Detroit, and it was segregated at that time and had just been exposed. I used to do a kind of Grosse Pointe matron. And that's what I did. When the student producer of the show was like kind of going around tearing his hair out saying, we need some material, I said, well, maybe I have something we can do. So I was able to just improvise around my social activities and my charitable works and my daughter's debut party and things like that. And of course, it was a sensation in the show because it was the only thing that had any content. And then I went on all the local shows and did it. And I thought, gee, I thought if I could only make a living doing this, it would be wonderful.
Did you ever think you'd get trapped in that character? Did you know right away you had other characters?
Oh,
too?
No, I never thought of that. That never occurred to me. No, that was just one expression of something.
So what was the next character?
Then I did the world's oldest beauty expert, and that was Lupe, Madame Lupe, and she's a character who, by her title, is very old, and her face is somewhat deteriorated, and then she rejuvenates it through a series of exercises and application of cream, and then she sneezes and it all falls down.
What would you do for auditions when you went to New York?
I could hardly ever get an audition. I couldn't sing. I mean, I wasn't trained to sing. And I got one audition with Julius Monk at the Plaza, and it was horrendous, humiliating. The person who sent me said he'd never speak to me again. I had totally jeopardized his reputation. And
what did you do that went so badly?
Well, who knows what I did. First of all, I didn't even have pictures.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I had just done, I had just participated in a documentary about Kitty Genovese, who was the young woman in New York who was murdered on the street, and while 38 people watched or listened and did nothing to help her. And so I had, I was playing Kitty Genovese, and it really consisted of very little except being dragged around the street. And but then I happened to have a production shot of myself lying on a stretcher, and the director had wanted me to have my eyes open, and so the photographer had shot me, but it was a he was leaning over me shooting, so it was a very strange angle and a very strange expression, but it was the only picture I had of myself, and I took that picture and gave it to Julius Monk when I went to this audition, and. And also, in the only song I knew, I had a wind-up Victrola, because I used to collect old 30s records, and I had a great old 30s record by Francis Maddox and the Playboys called There's Not a Real New Yorker in New York, and a very sophisticated, you know, kind of song of that period, and just the kind of thing that you would think would appeal to Julius Monk. But the bad part was I had learned it on this wind-up Victrola, so it didn't keep time. So when I got my friend of mine who played the piano, who could, you know, transpose and play quickly, I didn't have the record, but I tried to sing it for him, and he'd say, it can't be like that. I said, that's how it is. I couldn't learn it any other way because I'd learned it so, it was so imprinted on me in this strange, wavering time. And so you can imagine, and plus I was a nervous wreck. I mean, my legs are shaking, you know, in Harry Kellerman. When Barbara Harris does that audition and she's literally holding onto a pole, that's just about what was happening. I mean, I was sagging on a pole. I had dry mouth. I could barely get a sound out of my mouth. And then I had given him this awful picture of me lying on a stretcher. And so finally I had to say, and but he was very gentlemanly, and he let me, even after I finished this first song, which was just horrendous, he said, did I want to sing another one? Of course, I didn't have another one, so I tried to sing God Bless America. And he... then he would try to be cordial, and he said, thank you, or something like that. And I said, well, if you're not, in an effort to try to understand where we stood, I said, well, if you're not going to hire me, then I want my picture back. And that's so my friends, so this friend, this sort of acquaintance who had sent me, said that, you know, he said, well, I'll never send you for anything again, and you've totally jeopardized my professional reputation.
Lily Tomlin's my guest, and she's revived her one-woman show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. So what was your first big break? Was it before Laugh-In?
No, well, I mean, in terms of really high-profile public recognition, it was Laugh-In.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before that, I would say, you can trace it back as far as you can go. You could trace it back to when I got on, well, here's how far back I would go. It's more fun to start at the beginning. Let's say I got on Laugh-In, right? Well, how I got on Laugh-In was because George Schlatter saw a monologue that I'd done on Merv Griffin about a woman addicted to eating rubber objects. And how I got on Merv Griffin was I had played at the Upstairs or the Downstairs, and I got a great review in the New York Times from Vince Canby. He was doing nightclubs in those days. And I took that review, and I went to an agent who's died now. Her name was Gloria Sapphire. And I knew it was a small agency. I didn't want to get a big agency because I was totally unknown, and I wanted someone to pay special attention to me. And I went to see her, and I took that review, and she sent me over to the Merv Griffin show.
I remember when you used to do Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
You'd come out with a little notebook and read observations about daily absurdities.
Yeah.
That you jotted down in this little notebook. Did you actually keep a notebook like that?
I did for a while, yeah. I mean, that concept was largely Jane's idea because she can write so epigrammatically anyway. And even in the play, I mean, even though she's moving character and plot forward, almost every line has a perception. It's kind of astonishing. It's almost like, I forget how someone put it. It was almost like they said what the couplet was to Pope. You know, somehow she's almost able to write satire in couplets and one-liners and stuff, and yet she moves the plot and the character forward, and it seems naturalistic.
Did you have people writing for you? Were you ever given lines that you thought were really offensive?
Oh, yeah. And I was George Schlatter. You mean talking about Laugh-In?
Sure, yeah.
George Schlatter, who was the producer and who's a friend of mine, I'd go to him and I'd say, George, I can't say this or I can't do this. And he'd say, okay. He said, he'll say someone, you know, and he'd give it to somebody else and they would do it. But even now, occasionally, when I have the misfortune to see myself on an old Laugh-In rerun, I mean, I say that only because you just cringe sometimes, you know. A lot of people enjoy it. They tell me they really like it and much of it, but sometimes I see stuff I do. I can't believe certain things left my lips.
Like what?
Just stuff, awful stuff. Just, I thought I had so much consciousness, you know, but believe me, I didn't.
Are you diplomatic or theatrical when you're refusing to do something?
Depends on the circumstance. sometimes you can be diplomatic, and then sometimes you have to be theatrical.
What was your most theatrical way of saying no?
Oh, well, there's no way to describe this. This is just, you couldn't possibly do this in the media. I couldn't reveal myself. I mean, first of all, there's no limit to the language.
Right.
And there's no limit to the decibel level. And I've been in situations where it's just like, it just comes short of like, you know, beating each other with sticks. I mean, it can be extremely explosive and extremely over the top.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. You've acted in several movies. I think your first role, or at least the first role I saw you in, was Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Where you played the mother of two deaf children.
Right.
And this was not a comic role. And it was a really interesting change for
I think I got that role, too, because Altman didn't even, you know, he had no idea who I was.
Oh, so he couldn't typecast you.
Yeah, he didn't think that I was Ernestine like most everyone else did.
Oh, so what are some of the things you've learned about yourself as an actress working in other people's movies? You know, after working on your own on stage for so long.
Well, I have a hard time very often in a movie because I don't always understand the writer's or the director's vision.
Because you're used to having your own and Jane's, who you know very well, so it's a shared vision.
And so the things that they might select to depict the character sometimes don't serve what I think should be communicated. So I usually, and sometimes you have an easier time of it than others, like depending on the director's flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And receptability, you can come in with a whole bunch of stuff and let him or her select from it if it pleases them. Like, for instance, in 9 to 5, every single scene, I had it prepared from about 100 different angles because I couldn't understand always what the intention was going to be. And because I would be trying to get in something that clarified it for me, I would try to get it in at all different angles, you know, whether it was because I wanted Violet to be kind of the earth mother of the office because I wanted her to have several children, first of all, so that there'd be a reason for her to put up with Hart, the boss who so abused her. And I went to Colin, the director, and I said, I'd like to have, you know, like about 6 kids. I'd like to have some triplet bluebirds. And I want my mother to live with us, you know. And then I have this teenage boy, and I want a couple other kids. I wanted a whole bunch of kids, and I wanted them to be running in and out. When I'm talking to my son fixing the garage, I wanted the kids to be running in and out of the garage, you know, getting animals and cages and, you know, just like it's just a menagerie of every possible creature walking and flying. And then, I wanted a lot of kids' pictures pasted to my desk and all that stuff, and I wanted to always be taking the paper out of the wastebasket to take it home to my kids so they could draw on it, you know, be smoothing the paper out.
So whenever you do a role, do you go through that elaborate a process to figure out
sometimes,
who your character is?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
In a film particularly, as I say, only because I'm have a very hard time understanding the other person's vision.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. You're a feminist and grew up in the 50s, right? So you are coming of age before the contemporary feminist movement. Did you think of yourself when you were growing up as a, looking back, do you think when you were growing up that you were something of an intuitive feminist?
Yes, undoubtedly.
In what ways?
Well, first of all, I was extremely independent.
Mm-hmm.
I knew right, I was very, I was class conscious, extremely class conscious.
Yeah, and you were from working class family.
Right. And I was also very conscious of what options my father had as opposed to my mother. Even though I understood my father also had fewer options than somebody who was better educated. who had a whole, you know, just came from a different background. And so I understood the subtleties of all that, or some of them, let's say. I don't want to be too grandiose here in my perception. And then, and I don't know, I never liked anything. I never liked, it wasn't like I did feminist material. I just didn't like I didn't like material that was demeaning to me or anybody else. I just didn't like it. I didn't like it I didn't want to see myself do it, least of all, and I didn't like it in anybody else. And people would always say in those early days when you're doing stand-up, people say things like, oh, how can you do stand-up and stay feminine? How can you keep your femininity and do stand-up? You have to be so aggressive. And I say, you don't have to be aggressive, you know, and I don't want to see a man or a woman be aggressive or, you know, or do that kind of comedy. What's the point? So it wasn't like, whatever my sensibility was, it just didn't appeal to it.
You once described yourself as going through when you were young, a semi-hood period.
Yeah, well, I certainly did that.
What is a semi-hood period?
Well, it's almost like role-playing. You know, I was probably already a performer since I was a child, because I always put on shows, and I loved all these different people in our neighborhood and in our old apartment house. I mean, everybody was so interesting and so different and yet so similar. And all the different accents and the different foods and the different way they furnish their house and their politics or their lack of politics. So in a way, I think all those things were like costumes. You know, I played almost every role. I was very socially mobile, and I was hoodie part of the time, then I'd be Ivy League, then I'd be kind of artsy craftsy, and then I was bohemian, beatnik. You know, it's like a different role to play.
Well,
of course, it expresses your politics, whether intuitively or not, at that time.
Well, also, I think playing the hood and playing the bohemian can also get you out of having to play a mainstream gender role. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
You know, classical.
Although
female.
Hoodie girls were pretty much, you know, like off the cover of True Confessions.
Did you ever dress that way?
Oh, God, for sure. They go with Paul Malls, big lipstick, you know.
Now, your mother was a nurse's aide. Your father worked in a factory.
Right.
He was an alcoholic, I believe.
Yeah.
Did you have to grow up quickly because of that and take some of the control of the family into your own hands?
Oh, sure, I did, yeah. I have a brother, but I was the oldest of the two. And you just do. I think blue-collar kids are just more conscious of that kind of thing anyway. You live in a smaller house.
Mm-hmm.
You know pretty much everything that's going on.
How did the women's movement affect you as a performer? You were already performing when the women's movement really started organizing in the late 60s. You were already an intuitive feminist, but how did the presence of a movement help you out?
It stopped people from, you go on a talk show and it became less acceptable for people to say, well, don't you want to have any children?
Right.
You know, or something like that. I mean, it just expanded everybody. Even if it didn't expand them organically, it expanded them superficially enough so that they had a different mode of behavior in public.
One last thing. I want you to describe what you wore to the Academy Awards ceremony when you were up for an award for Best Supporting Actress from Nashville.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to go because the Oscars was, first of all, this was back in 1975 or whatever it was. And the Oscars was such a cultural event, and still is, but I mean, it really was then. And all you live your whole life, a child, a kid in Detroit, and the Oscars are like the ultimate experience. And, I mean, ultimate television pop experience. So I wanted to go as a 50s movie star. And I actually should have worn a blonde wig, but I didn't, you know, because then it would be hard to recognize me. So I wore my own hair. But I wore, you know, I went to NBC's costume department and I got a knit dress that has like great sequins sewn, spangles, you know, and it's very stretchy. It's kind of a Marilyn Monroe kind of dress. You have to be very fleshy to fill it out. And so I was padded, you know, I padded myself just enough so that it looked real, but it was pretty voluptuous. And I had great big white foxes and great rhinestone earrings and a tiara and just loaded with rhinestones, and I had Harlequin rhinestone glasses on, and And so I went, because my plan was if I won, I was going to go up and I was going to say, some of you will say I've gone Hollywood. So, but the best part was Mr. Blackwell, the next morning on TV, he said, and Lily Tomlin wore a tiara. We just don't wear tiaras.
Did you feel then, or do you ever feel now, that you're like impersonating a celebrity, you know?
No, not in this part I don't, but I mean that kind of thing I do.
Yeah.
I mean, then I want to have fun with great cultural events, you know. Like Ernestine was nominated for an Emmy a few years ago, and I went to the Emmys as Ernestine, and the Academy was just furious with me. Because they think, to me, it's the greatest tribute I can pay is that I'd be that invested, yeah. you know, in Ernestine winning an Emmy. I mean, Ernestine would have given anything to win an Emmy. I mean, much more than I would. And so I made great elaborate preparations for her. She had two limousines. She had her own film crew. She had Irish wolfhounds. She had everything to present herself at the Emmys. And, of course, she didn't win. And when she didn't, I had a black silk hanky in case I didn't win. And Dwight Himian and Gary Smith were the producer and director. And so they thought this was funny. The president of the Academy, behind whom I was sitting, did not think it was funny at all. So when I lost, the camera was on my face for just a moment, you know, and I was very stoic. And then I whipped out that hanky and sobbed into it. But I got the greatest postcard from a CBS executive the next day. She wrote me and she said, Ernestine, you were a vision of dignity and pathos.
Lily Tomlin, thanks so much for talking with us.